From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Israelis vote in a test for Prime Minister Netanyahu. Where did ISIS come from? UNICEF says the Ebola crisis is not over until cases reach zero. And an Obama administration trip to Asia to promote girls' education.
From a political standpoint and a security standpoint, places where women and girls are treated as full and equal citizens tend to be more stable, tend to be more democratic.
I'm Susan Yawkey. Voters are going to the polls in Israel, where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is seeking a fourth term as prime minister. Visiting various voting stations is VOA correspondent Scott Bobb. He spoke with us from Beit Safafa, a predominantly Arab neighborhood in Jerusalem.
In western parts of Jerusalem, in the predominantly Jewish neighborhoods, voters turned out early and in large numbers. And according to election officials, this could be the heaviest turnout in quite some time. That is being attributed to the tight race between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party and the opposition labor-led center-left alliance led by Isaac Herzog. But other issues are also involved, and that is that there is a contest between, on the right side, between the right-wing parties, and on the left, between the left-wing parties, and many say that it'll be the center-left parties, a couple of smaller parties, that may be the ones that are the kingmakers in this election.
What is the feeling there about this election? Are people excited?
I think more people are voting than did because they do feel it's a tight contest. There is a strong movement in some parts of the electorate to have anybody but Prime Minister Netanyahu, and this has encouraged some people to come out. But this has also encouraged the right wing to defend its positions, and especially in regards to security.
Well, Mr. Netanyahu appears to have changed his stance a bit on the Palestinian statehood issue.
He is probably voicing that opinion, although some of his officials say that it really has not changed, but more to appeal to the right-wing voters. He feels that there has been defection from his Likud party to more hardline right-wing parties, and he's trying to get those people to come back and vote for him by reassuring him on issues like the settlements and Jerusalem, and in this case, the talks with the Palestinians. He has earlier in the campaign said that the Palestinian issue is not on the table because one of the Palestinians going to the International Court of Justice unilaterally seeking redress for some grievances, and two, talking with the militant Hamas movement that controls Gaza, which does not recognize Israel. So these are two points that the Prime Minister feels that just make any dialogue a non-starter and not worth the effort. So he basically is just hammering that home a little bit harder on the eve of the election.
Well, when neither candidate wins the 61-seat parliamentary majority, what will the next step be?
Well, then the deal-making goes into effect. The president of Israel, Mr. Reuven, will then summon each of the parties and talk to them, and they will recommend one leader over another to form the government. He then will choose the candidate as a designated prime minister that he feels could best form the government. This could be the party that wins the most votes, but it could also be the party that has the best chance of forming a solid, stable coalition. So it could go either way. The president of Israel is known to favor a unity government. That is a government that would include both Mr. Netanyahu's party and the labor-led center-left alliance, but that may not be possible. And one third factor involved is, if that should happen, then the United Arab List that is looks like could become the third biggest winner in this election would then become the head of the opposition. And it's quite likely that the other parties would not like to see this because that would give them even more clout than they look like they're going to gain in this vote.
Well, Scott, if I could just ask you one more question while I have you on the line. Benjamin Netanyahu gave a speech here to Congress, which was quite controversial in the United States because the Congress invited him to come without asking the White House, which is a little bit against protocol. What is the feeling in Israel about his speech? Is this going to contribute any way to this election?
The feelings tended to divide along partisan lines here, just as they did in the United States. Mr. Netanyahu's supporters felt that it was fine to do that, that it was an important message that needed to be said to the American public and the American Congress. His opponents said it was pure campaigning and is meant just to gain votes. So to a degree, it backfired and seemed to be so reflected in the polls right up until the end of the campaign. But he may have regained some ground by, again, hammering home on some of these security issues and the Israel-Palestinian issue, as you mentioned.
VOA correspondent Scott Bob in Beit Safafa, Jerusalem. The head of the United Nations Commission of Inquiry on Syria said today that the investigators are prepared to release the names of those on its list of accused human rights violators. The commission released its latest report on the conflict, saying it has resisted publishing its private list of accused abusers, but that to continue keeping it secret would reinforce the impunity present in Syria. Commission head Paulo Pinheiro specified the names would not be made public. Russia and China have each vetoed multiple draft Security Council resolutions on Syria since the conflict there began in March 2011. The commission report says that without a consensus for action on the council, there should be consideration for creating an international tribunal to address war crimes allegations. The perpetrators have for more than 4 years committed crimes that shock the conscience of humanity, raises questions about the inadequacy of the response of the international community, it says. The militant group calling itself the Islamic State has gained international attention for its use of social media as a tool in recruiting young Muslims from around the world. The group's recruitment campaign had largely gone unnoticed because of its use of an encrypted application that allowed it to establish unmonitored channels to share messages through computers and smartphones. A recent book, Inside the Army of Terror, by American journalist Michael Weiss and Syrian analyst Hassan Hassan, traces the group's evolution from a nearly defeated Iraqi insurgent faction into a jihadi army that controls territory equal to the size of Britain. The book also explains how ISIS recruits, governs, and guards itself from potential bottom-up rebellions. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with co-author Hassan Hassan about how the militants hid on the Internet as they promoted their radical version of Islam among young people.
Against the conspiracy theory in the Arab world that ISIS is manufactured by the United States or the Israeli Mossad, how did this terrorist group evolve?
I think there's this tendency to think of ISIS as a group that was created like a year or two years ago. But ISIS has been in existence for more than a decade, for 11 years, in fact. It was a product of the Iraq War. It evolved from a small group within Iraqi insurgency into a homegrown organization that was dominated by Iraqis, and it was remodeled to be a state, an Islamic state. And, it went through different stages. At some point in 2007, it was almost completely eliminated. It was forced into the desert of Anbar because the American military and the Iraqi government and the Sunnis worked together to fight it, successfully so. After that, the fight against ISIS, or ISI at the time, was neglected, was seen as not a priority. The American forces withdrew from Iraq. The Iraqi government started to become visibly more sectarian, and Sunnis started to drift towards groups like ISIS. Or ISI still at the time. After the Arab Spring and especially the Syrian uprising, ISIS, as we know it today, benefited from the power vacuum, from the chaos, and from the grievances of people to build itself and remodel itself and rebrand itself to become a caliphate, or announce itself to be a caliphate. So it wasn't born yesterday. It goes through a long history.
What role did the Syrian regime play in facilitating ISIS expansion instead of fighting against this terrorist group?
The Assad regime's role was to allow ISIS to grow and fester in Syria. When ISIS controlled Raqqa, for example, in early 2013, the Assad regime did not bomb ISIS bases, although ISIS painted government buildings with black, and they were hosting activities around the buildings and inside the buildings. But the Assad regime did not fight ISIS. In fact, there is evidence that the Assad regime and ISIS had agreements over like oil sharing and service provision and so on within the black market. And for a year, the Assad regime just allowed ISIS to grow and operate. And sometimes even when ISIS fights other rebels, the Assad regime would seize the opportunity and start bombing rebel areas. So ISIS benefited a lot from the Assad regime.
Can you explain the relationship between ISIS and the former officers from Saddam Hussein army and their military tactics?
So yeah, the top leadership in ISIS is dominated by former Ba'athist officials, people who served with Saddam Hussein. They are either security officials, intelligence officials, or ordinary Ba'athists. They benefited from the expertise and, you know, the skills they had in the past to create a group that is formidable, that is able to send spies and ears and eyes to neighboring countries. In research for the book, we found that people actually operate from Turkey, and they don't always show that they are ISIS. They might be clean-shaved. They don't look like ISIS members, and they operate from Turkey, from Jordan, from elsewhere, because they wanna see what's going on around them, so they preempt any kind of move against them. So the Ba'athists within ISIS are very important for the group.
How does ISIS govern, recruit, and guards itself from potential bottom-up rebellions?
ISIS works very hard to entrench itself in, within areas under its control. They take a variety of measures to make sure that there are no bottom-up rebellion against them. They do that by eliminating any potential rivalry. Any activist who operates in their area is marked for death. Any influential person, who might be a potential threat for ISIS will be eliminated under, you know, different pretexts. And they govern by, they try to provide law and order in their areas. They provide services. Like, they act as a state, so they ensure transportation in bakeries, in government facilities. And they recruit also for through a variety of reasons. Some of the reasons actually related to governance, because they are good at governance and because they have established law and order in their areas. Some people find no alternative but to join ISIS. But there are people who join ISIS for other reasons, mostly religious reasons and political reasons. People who believe in the political project of ISIS as a restoration of Sunni domination, and also religious project, which is kind of that Salafi, jihadi, purist ideology.
Hassan Hassan, co-author of Inside the Army of Terror. We hope to bring you more of his remarks Wednesday on International Edition. As war in Syria enters its fifth year, half the population has been displaced and 4 million people have left the country. With no end to the conflict in sight, however, it is not just Syria that is reeling. Resources in neighboring countries are stretched to the limit. In the Jordanian capital, workers say prices and tensions are rising quickly as international aid becomes harder to attain. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Amman.
There are no bombs going off these days in Jordan, but families say since the Syria war began, everything has changed. Salah Awad is a taxi driver and the father of 9 children. As he eats lunch with his family off a large cloth on the floor, he says rent has gone up by 75% in recent years. And as refugees pour out of Iraq as well as Syria, he says, competition from laborers who will work for almost nothing makes it almost impossible to make enough money to pay the bills. 10% of the people in Jordan are now refugees from Syria, but international aid is dwindling along with the patience of host countries, says Andrew Walker, who heads the United Nations Refugee Agency in Jordan.
Over time, the Walker mat gets thinner and thinner. I think the security situation in the region magnifies the concerns of Jordanians of what the impact the refugees have.
The impact, he says, includes sharing the limited resources of Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, the countries where most Syrian refugees now live. The United Nations is seeking $3 billion for Jordan alone, but so far has raised only 5% of the money.
And on top of that, you see the fighting that's going on inside Iraq and the displacement which is going on there. One of the challenges is, what, when does this stop? Mm-hmm. How long do we have to keep trying to provide a humanitarian response to the political failures?
These political failures, he adds, could also spread the security crisis into neighboring countries. Outside Salah's house, his 15-year-old son, Zaid, entertains his younger siblings. He says no one expects the nearby wars to end soon, and he plans to join the military after he finishes school. He says he plans to defend the homeland, but his father says fears the war could expand are not nearly as troubling as fears the economy will further deteriorate, driving Jordanians from their homes and adding to the millions of displaced in the region. Salah adds, after 4 years of war, he is increasingly anxious because every day it becomes more difficult to feed his children. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Amman, Jordan.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
The United Nations Children's Fund warns the Ebola epidemic will continue to devastate the lives of children and their communities in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, as long as one case of this deadly disease remains. From Geneva, Lisa Schlein reports that UNICEF is urging swift, effective action to bring the number of Ebola cases down to zero.
The three presidents of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea have set April 15th as the goal for reaching zero cases of Ebola. The UNICEF representative in Sierra Leone, Roland Monash, tells VOA it is hard to predict whether this wished-for goal will be reached.
Every day I look at my emails on the end of the day to look at the score, and every day I pray it's zero, but every day, unfortunately, it isn't. We call it a bumpy road to zero. It's going up and it's going down. We see days when we have 20, 25 cases. We have see days when we have two or three cases.
The World Health Organization reports nearly 24,600 cases of Ebola, including 10,144 deaths in the three West African countries. The UN Children's Fund reports 20% of these infections are among children. In addition, the agency notes more than 16,000 children have lost one or both parents to this disease. Monar says children also remain vulnerable to other killer diseases. He says Sierra Leone has the highest under 5 mortality rate in the world, and this has risen in the last 9 to 12 months because of Ebola. The UNICEF representative says it is crucial to start building better basic health facilities so children can access non-Ebola health services, which have broken down during the course of the epidemic.
Children are dying from very easily preventable diseases like malaria, diarrhea, pneumonia. And as UNICEF, we've been working very closely with the ministries of health to make sure that there are health workers, to make sure that there are medicines in place. But unfortunately, people are so afraid to come to the clinics to be identified to be an Ebola patient or to get infected by Ebola that children are dying at home of preventable diseases.
UNICEF says the outbreak will not be over until there are zero cases of Ebola. To get there, it says every single contact has to be traced and monitored to make sure no hidden cases remain. The agency warns against the enormous risk of complacency. It says people must not let down their guard because they believe the epidemic is over and revert to behavior that could again spread the disease. UNICEF says communities must continue to conduct safe burials and households where Ebola is detected must be quarantined. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
First Lady Michelle Obama embarks on a 5-day Asia trip Wednesday to launch the Obama administration's initiative, Let's Girls Learn, to promote the education of millions of girls worldwide. VOA's Victor Beatty reports, ahead of her stops in Japan and Cambodia, Ms. Obama and her husband warned the inability of an estimated 62 million girls to attend school worldwide should be a foreign policy priority.
The First Lady wrote in the Wall Street Journal that the fact that tens of millions of girls are not being adequately educated is more than a tragic waste of human potential. It is also, she says, a serious public health challenge, a drag on national economies, as well as global prosperity, and a threat to the security of countries around the world. Mrs. Obama says, as of 2012, every developing region had achieved or was close to achieving gender parity in primary education. But she says a gender gap remains in secondary education, where girls are subjected to, quote, the cultural values and practices that define and limit the prospects of women in their societies. In launching the Let Girls Learn campaign earlier this month, Mrs. Obama said the Peace Corps, the U.S.-funded volunteer development agency, would play a key role.
This effort will draw on the talent and energy of the nearly 7,000 Peace Corps volunteers serving in more than 60 countries. Through this effort, Peace Corps will be supporting hundreds of new community projects to help girls go to school and stay in school. And I want to emphasize that these programs will be community-generated and community-led. They'll be based on solutions devised by local leaders, families, and yes, even the girls themselves.
At the same event, President Obama says his administration is making clear to partner countries this is a foreign policy priority.
We know that when girls are educated, they're more likely to delay marriage. Their future children, as a consequence, are more likely to be healthy and better nourished. Their future wages increase, which in turn strengthens the security of their family. And national growth gets a boost as well. From a political standpoint and a security standpoint, places where women and girls are treated as full and equal citizens tend to be more stable, tend to be more democratic. So this is not just a humanitarian issue. This is an economic issue, and it is a security issue. And that's why it has to be a foreign policy priority.
Mrs. Obama's first stop is Japan, where she will meet Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and his wife, Akie. The Peace Corps and Japan's equivalent overseas cooperation volunteers are to work together on the campaign. Michael Kuchek, an adjunct fellow at Temple University's Institute of Contemporary Asian Studies in Tokyo, says the First Lady's visit is receiving wide press coverage. He says the visit is seen as buttressing the special U.S.-Japan relationship. He also says education has long been a personal priority of the Abes.
Mr. Abe has long been involved in education policy, but in addition, he and his wife run a charity that builds schools in Myanmar, and they've been doing it for actually quite some time. So it's not really out of place for Akie-sama to come forward at this time to meet with very publicly with Michelle Obama on this issue, because she herself has been involved in it.
The First Ladies will meet Japanese university students. Before leaving Japan, Mrs. Obama will also stop in Kyoto to tour a Buddhist temple and Shinto shrine. In Cambodia, the senior director for Asian affairs at the U.S. National Security Council said Mrs. Obama will touch on the need for an open and inclusive political system and to allow civil society to have a role in good governance. Human Rights Deputy Asia Director Phil Robertson says Cambodia is a work in progress when it comes to girls' education.
And in fact, we just released a report last week about the women and girls in the garment sector, which is the major export industry of Cambodia. Over 92% of the workers in that industry are women and girls. We found that there are systematic abuses taking place in the garment factories in Cambodia. Sending products to the likes of Gap and others overseas. And the problem that we found was, girls are going into these factories. That, for all extensible purposes, is the end of their education.
Robertson says many of the girls are driven to the factories because of food insecurity at home. The rights report says many of them face pregnancy discrimination and sexual harassment on the job. He says this issue should be on Mrs. Obama's agenda while in Cambodia. The Southeast Asian nation is one of 11 countries partnering in the Let Girls Learn campaign. Mrs. Obama, the first U.S. lady to visit Cambodia, is scheduled to travel to Siem Reap, where she'll meet her Cambodian counterpart, Bun Rani, wife of Prime Minister Hun Sen, speak with students and volunteers, and see some community programs said to be expanding girls' education opportunities. Before returning to Washington, Mrs. Obama is to visit the ancient temple at Angkor Wat. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can also re-listen to this program if you like. Go to the Programs tab and scroll down to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.